Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo
bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 18 of the first canto. Maharaj Parikshit cursed by a Brahmana boy. And text one is on the board, and we are slated to read through text 17. It's a new challenge trying to read seven, as I understand the task, to I looked at all 17 verses and tried to choose which one or two purports maybe to read. That's hard to do if you're not used to doing that. So I picked a couple, hopefully they'll be appropriate. So Suto vacha ya vai droni astra viplushtaha na matoho udare nitaha anugrahat bhagavataha krishnasya adbhuta karmanaha suto vacha Yo vai dronyastra viprusto namator udare mritaha anugrahat bhagavataha krishnasya bhutta karmanaha suto vacha Yo vai dronyastra viprusto Namator udare mrita Anugrahad bhagavataha Krishnashad bhutta karmanaha We're meaning Sutta Vacha. Sri Sutta Goswami said, Ya, one who, Vai, certainly, Droni Astra, By the weapon of the son of Drona. Viplushta. Who's the son of Drona?
Ashvatthama.
Viplushta. Burnt by. Na. Never. Matuhu. Of the mother. Udare. In the womb of. Nitaha. Met his death. Anugrahat. By the mercy of Bhagavata, of the personality of Godhead, Krishnasya, of Krishna, Adbhuta Karmanaha, of one who acts wonderfully. Translation. Sri Sutta Goswami said, due to the mercy of the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who acts wonderfully, Maharaj Parikshit, though struck by the weapon of the son of Drona in his mother's womb, could not be burnt. What was that weapon? Brahmastra, capable of destroying the worlds, but still couldn't kill him because Krishna protected him. So please repeat. Sri Sutta Goswami said, due to the mercy of the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, who acts wonderfully, Maharaj Parikshit, though struck by the weapon of the son of Drona in his mother's womb, could not be burnt. So I'm just going to go ahead and read all the way through 17 and then we'll pick one purport. So text 2, I'll just read in English. Furthermore, Maharaj Parikshit was always consciously surrendered to the personality of Godhead, and therefore he was neither afraid nor overwhelmed by fear due to a snake bird which was to bite him because of the fury of a Brahmana boy. Where I live, they have a new thing that they think was brought in somehow from China called a snake fish. And it eats everything, and it crawls from lake to lake. So when they first found it in the area, they thought this is the end of civilization as we know it, and they were draining lakes and ponds everywhere, and they were paying people, if you find a snake fish, you bring it to us, we'll, you know, so we can kill them, we'll give you a reward. They were very worried. But now they're everywhere, and they can't stop it. So Maharaj Pariksit was not afraid of a snake bird, but modern people are very afraid just of a simple snake fish. But he was not afraid of the snake bird. Why? Because he was consciously surrendered to the personality of Godhead. Text 3. Furthermore, these snake fish, they're really gross looking. It's like a fish. You can just imagine a fish. He swims and then he crawls from place to place. And because it's not indigenous, it's just killing everything. So, you know, it's a symptom of Kali Yuga. Furthermore, after leaving all his associates, the king surrendered himself as a disciple to the son of Vyas, Sukadeva Goswami, and thus he was able to understand the actual position of the personality of Godhead. This was so because those who have dedicated their lives to the transcendental topics of the personality of Godhead, of whom the Vedic hymns sing, and who are constantly engaged in remembering the lotus feet of the Lord, do not run the risk of having misconceptions at the last moment of their lives. You can all start to see why it's impossible to choose one purport, because these are all really important points. But as long as the great powerful Abhimanyu remains the emperor of the world, who is the powerful son of Abhimanyu? Pariksit Maharaj, yes. There's no chance of the personality of Kali flourishing. The very day and moment the personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, left this earth, the personality of Kali, who promotes all kinds of irreligious activities, came into this world. It's the very moment. Maharaj Pariksit was a realist. Like the bees who only accept the essence of a flower, he knew perfectly well that in this age of Kali, auspicious things produce good effects immediately, whereas inauspicious acts must be actually performed to render effects. So he was never envious of the personality of Kali. Maharaj Pariksit considered that less intelligent men might find the personality of Kali to be very powerful, but that those who are self-controlled would have nothing to fear. The king was powerful like a tiger and took care for the foolish, careless persons. Text 9. O sages, as you did ask me, now I have almost described everything regarding the narrations about Lord Krishna in connection with the history of the pious Maharaj Pariksit. Those who are desirous of achieving complete perfection in life must submissively hear all topics that are connected with the transcendental activities and qualities of the personality of Godhead, who acts wonderfully. The good sages said, text 11, O grave Sutta Goswami, may you live many years and have eternal fame, for you are speaking very nicely about the activities of Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead. This is just like nectar for mortal beings like us. Shamsasi, speaking nicely. I've often wondered, where does this word nice come from? Such an ISKCON word. Everything's nice. Prasadam is nice. Class was nice. Kirtan was nice. Association is nice. So now we know it's bona fide now. It was first spoken by the sages to Sutta Goswami. They said, you are speaking very nicely. So it's official. We can use this word now. We have just begun performance of this fruit of activity, a sacrificial fire, without certainty of its result, due to many imperfections in our action. Our bodies have become black from the smoke. We are factually pleased by the nectar of the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead Govinda, the nectar of the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead Govinda, which you are distributing. The value of a moment's association with the devotees of the Lord cannot be even compared to the attainment of heavenly planets or liberation from matter. What to speak of worldly benedictions in the form of material prosperity, which is for those who are meant for death. Every other verse I'm thinking, maybe I should read that purport instead of the one I chose. Text 14, the personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna Govinda, is the exclusive shelter for all great living beings. And his transcendental attributes cannot even be measured by such masters of mystic powers as Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. Can anyone who is expert in relishing nectar, rasa, ever be fully satiated by hearing topics about him? O Sutta Goswami, you are a learned and pure devotee of the Lord because the personality of Godhead is your chief object of service. Therefore, please describe to us the pastimes of the Lord which are above all material conception, for we are anxious to receive such message. You are a learned and pure devotee of the Lord because the personality of Godhead is your chief object of service. O Sutta Goswami, please describe those topics of the Lord by which Maharaj Parikshit, whose intelligence was fixed on liberation, attained the lotus feet of the Lord, who is the shelter of Garuda, the king of birds. Those topics were vibrated by the son of Vyas, Srila Shukadev. Last verse. Thus, please narrate to us the narrations of the unlimited, for they are purifying and supreme. They were spoken to Maharaj Parikshit, and they are very dear to the pure devotees, being full of bhakti yoga. Om jnana tamyam dasha jnana anjana shalakaya chakshu umritamena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manobhishtam stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa gadami yam didata svapinattikam jai shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shri advaita gadadhar shri vasadi gaur bhaktivedanta Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So here in this section leading up to this, we've been hearing about the final pastimes of Lord Krishna in this volume. We read about the departure of Dhritarashtra, which is interesting that that's included because he's such a troubled personality. He's a very much a cause of all of the difficulties in the Mahabharata because of his weak-willed inability to reprimand, to contain his son. He was told at the birth of Duryodhana, I believe by Narada, was it Narada? Who came and said, this son will lead to the death of your dynasty, the destruction of the world, you should kill him. Somebody, great personality came, and of course he couldn't do it then, and then throughout his life he couldn't contain his son, and you know, he kept saying, what can I do, what can I do? And everyone would say, well, you're the king, do something. And he'd say, what can I do, what can I do? I'm overwhelmed by my affection for my son. And of course, we know the end, everybody was killed in the war, and then Dhritarashtra, it's amazing, his somehow, by the mercy of the association of his brother, he was able to leave home and engage in the process of mystic yoga at the end of his life. So his whole end of his life is contained in the Bhagavatam. And then the story of King Parikshit we've been reading. We just read the departure of the Pandavas, and now King Parikshit's life, grandson of the Pandavas, and his activities as a king, chastising Kali, containing Kali, and now being cursed by the Brahmana boy and the later appearance of the snake bird. The whole thing is being pointed to here. So here, Sutta Goswami is describing Parikshit Maharaj, the beginning of the age of Kali, and talking through these verses about the importance of hearing and chanting. And the sages are talking with Sutta Goswami. They're saying, we've started this yajna. We know we're supposed to do something, but the age of Kali is so strong that we can't even perform these sacrifices anymore. And what to do? And therefore, being described the importance of, in this age of Kali, associating with devotees and hearing from the devotees. So I would select a text 7 purport to read. Prabhupada talks about the age of Kali. He writes, the age of Kali is called the fallen age. Anyone ever feel like you're falling? Or maybe fallen? Or being taken as a fall guy? They say that in English, taken as the fall guy, and you're tricked, you're cheated. If so, It's natural. It's the age. In this fallen age, because of the living beings being in an awkward position, how often do we feel we're in an awkward position? So often in an awkward position. The Supreme Lord has given some special facilities to them. So in an awkward position, the Lord gives special facilities. Where I live in the United States, Washington, D.C., a woman that works for me, she also does volunteer work at one of the military hospitals. And it's a place where they take care of the soldiers who've lost limbs in Iraq or Afghanistan. And very awkward position. The government sent them someplace, and if they come back alive, so many of them are coming back without limbs. So now they have all this technology to give them artificial limbs. It's a very awkward position, but the government's at least trying to give them some facility so that they can continue. So Kali Yuga is a very awkward position, but we're being given some special facility. So just like the man who loses limbs, if he doesn't take advantage of those artificial limbs, his life's going to be very difficult. So ours will also be difficult, but there's special opportunities we can take advantage of. By the will of the Lord, a living being does not become a victim of a sinful act until the act is actually performed. In other ages, simply by thinking of performing a sinful act, one used to become a victim of the act. On the contrary, a living being in this age is awarded with the results of pious acts simply by thinking of them. So we hear this sometimes. Here's where Prabhupada specifically refers to it. In the age of Kali, if you think of something sinful, you don't get the reaction. In previous ages, even if you thought of something, you know, you get mad at somebody, you say, I'd like to punch them in the face, you get the reaction for that. In this age, you only get the reaction if you punch them in the face. So we have like that extra time to go, I better not do this, okay? So that's a special benediction for us in this age. One of the benedictions to help us. Maharaj Parikshit, being the most learned and experienced king by the grace of the Lord, was not unnecessarily envious of the personality of Kali because he did not intend to give him any chance to perform any sinful act. It's an interesting description. He was not unnecessarily envious of the personality of Kali because he did not intend to give him any chance to perform a sinful act. He wasn't disturbed, even though he knows he's such a disturbing personality. He wasn't disturbed by him because he knew how to contain him. So perhaps in the same way we should, if we know how to contain the effects of Kali, how to minimize them by the grace of the Lord, we also cannot be so disturbed. Parikshit Maharaj protected his subjects from falling prey to the sinful acts of the age of Kali, and at the same time he gave full facility to the age of Kali by allotting him some particular places. He has many places in these days. At the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said that even though all nefarious activities of the personality of Godhead are present, there is a great advantage in the age of Kali. What's that? Yes, anybody know that verse? I used to know that one. Kalero no she nidhara ajan asti eko mahajanaha kirtanani vikrishna sha dasangam paramurjat. Translation?
Although this age is an ocean of faults, there's still one mahaguna, great quality that just by chanting Krishna, one can attain liberation.
So, although it's an ocean of faults, still one can attain. There's one special benediction. One can attain salvation simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord. One can attain salvation simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord. I'm repeating, probably doesn't. One can attain salvation simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord. Thus, Maharaj Parikshit made an organized effort to propagate the chanting of the Lord's holy name. Sounds like ISKCON's first statement of our purposes, right? To systematically propagate spiritual knowledge to society at large. So Prabhupada says, here, we're following in the footsteps of Parikshit Maharaj, who made an organized effort to propagate chanting of the Lord's holy name. And thus he saved the citizens from the clutches of Kali. It is for this advantage only that great sages sometimes wish all good for the age of Kali. They don't feel bad about it. They think, oh, it's a nice time. The special benediction. And the Vedas also, it is said that by the discourse on Lord Krishna's activities, one can get rid of all the disadvantages of the age of Kali. In the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is also said that by the recitation of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Supreme Lord becomes at once arrested within one's heart. Arrested within one's heart. These are some of the great advantages of the age of Kali, and Pariksit Maharaj took all the advantages and did not think any ill of the age of Kali, true to his Vaishnavite cult. Jai Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. So I think I heard three advantages. One, you're not held responsible for thinking sinful thoughts. Two, one can attain perfection simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord. And three, actually one that's not necessarily just for age of Kali, but Prabhupada says, by the recitation of the Bhagavatam, the Lord becomes arrested within one's heart. So these are all advantages that we have. Bhagavatam is there in this age. So these sages are discussing the difficulty of the age of Kali. And generally, if one is just a little bit conscious, we all know these things. This is something not so difficult to explain. It's analyzed in some detail. We know earlier in the first canto is explained there's, in this age in particular, men have what there's a six difficulties. I was trying to remember that, I only could remember four. Right? In this age, we are short lived, unlucky, quarrelsome, always disturbed. And there's two more.
Misguided.
That's an important one. I was thinking maybe it's short memory because I couldn't remember the other two, but I couldn't remember whether it was or not.
But, above all disturbed.
Yeah, I get that. We got that one. Above all, always disturbed. Yeah, we said that. Short-lived, misguided, unlucky, quarrelsome. Quarrelsome. Yeah. We said that too? Yeah. Okay, so there's six. We can quarrel about it later. And we know there's the three pains, right? Adiatmic, adibaudic, adidaivic. Those things are always there. And then we know there's the four essential truths of the universe: birth, death, old age, and disease. So at every angle, different analysis of these different problems. So it's being explained here. There's all these difficulties are there. But we see, despite all these difficulties, people are working really, really hard, trying to become happy, trying to overcome them. So I remember thinking before as a devotee, when I was first getting some sense of the struggles, it's like, well, why am I working so hard if it's so difficult? Perhaps some Vaishnav told me, well, that, and it made sense. Well, that's the proof there's something else. You're looking for that something else because that's kind of like your natural condition. It's like if you're thrown in, you know, icy cold water, you want to get out. Why? Because there's a sense that there's something better than this. If you burn your hand, you want to pull it away because there's a sense of not feeling pain. So we're motivated to look for those places where we're free from pain. So it's our nature. Prabhupada, I like the reference one time, Prabhupada was asked, maybe more than once, but he was asked in this context, what's the purpose of life? And, you know, Prabhupada could say different things at different times, but at least this one time he said to enjoy, which is our Vaishnav supreme purpose, Jai Shishirana Kopinath, to enjoy being with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and glorifying Him and serving Him and increasing His pleasure. And in this way, we enjoy. So the Shastra kind of repeatedly talks about the miseries of life and then talks about how we're actually meant to enjoy. There's this tension there. So then the question is, if we're meant to enjoy, but it seems this world is not such an easy place to enjoy, well, where can we enjoy? Where can we find satisfaction? And I was thinking about being here at the an association of the students of the Bhaktivedanta College. I was remembering some experiences in my college years, many of which I wouldn't speak about in Bhagavatam class, but some I can. And I remember really clearly something that kind of gave me a lot of impetus. I went to a college not too far from my parents' home, and they, one year they came with a group of their friends, as they'd done every year as like a, some kind of, you know, sangha with this particular group of friends. They came to the college football game that weekend, so they invited me out to dinner with their friends. So I'm there with like three or four couples, husband and wife, friends of my parents. And I remember this one man, kind of a jovial guy, and he was telling me, he said, how's it going, and what are you studying, and you having a good time, and this and that. And I remember he told me, he said, just make sure you really enjoy your college years, because these are going to be the best years of your life. And I immediately thought, if these are the best years of my life, I'm really in trouble. Because I was very conscious. I'm struggling. There's so much social pressure and, trying to find, the perfect girlfriend that won't break your heart and avoiding the girls that you're breaking their heart and all the competition between friends and the pressure to get ahead and so much anxiety. And so this is the best years of my life. What happens next, And I could see, even with a little bit maybe later through the lens of Christian philosophy, but he was just lamenting. His whole thing was, oh yeah, it was so good back then, and now I'm whatever he was, 50, and life's not so good, but boy, it was great in college. And I didn't say anything to him, but I was thinking, it's not so good in college, it's a mess, And then, of course, I thought, wow, then anything else he tells me, what good is his advice? I'll follow his advice and get a degree, get a job, get a wife, get a house, get a few kids, make some money, retire, and be miserable like you are. I don't want to do that. Is there some other option? So, of course, we see in this world, it's a fact, some people are relatively happy and enjoying life, and according to their different karma, they experience different things. I was having an interesting discussion with a devotee recently. He was kind of talking about my experience is my mind is never stops. It's always talking to me. Like when I read in the Gita, the mind's the worst enemy. It's like, phew. That was one of those things. I read that and I thought, this book really knows what's going on in the world. And I was talking to another devotee and they were kind of about, somewhere I was talking about silence and, chanting and just being able to really focus the mind. And they were saying, yeah. I really like it when I feel silence. And I said, silence? When do you feel silence? I don't think I've ever experienced silence. And it was a real kind of an eye-opening thing for me because I realized, oh, so different people really do have different experiences. And I was thinking sometimes maybe because I have a little bit of a philosophical mind, so the analysis of the shortcomings of the world kind of ring true to me. And I realized, but other people, sometimes they don't necessarily see like that. They actually think, life's pretty good. I got an okay job and, 32% of the population is out of work, but I got a job. And, I got a house, I got a big dog and, I got an alarm system and I got some money put away in the bank and I got an automated garage I can drive into and lock the door and I don't see all those problems. But even then, one who's a little thoughtful understands, yes, but how long will it last? And that's where the difficulty and anxiety comes in for one even who's experiencing some relative degree of pleasure. And why is that? Because ultimately this is in our home. We're meant to be happy with Krishna eternally and not just some kind of temporary situation. And Krishna's constantly reminding us of this. Recently I went on my son travels and does yoga, kirtans, and things like that, various places in the world. And last year, after Christmas, he went to a place he goes to pretty regularly in the Bahamas, which, is like heavenly planet. And I'd never gone, and didn't really want to go, but he didn't have anybody else going with him. So my wife and I went with him to be his backup band, which is great, because we got a free place to stay and nice vegetarian meals for the whole week, and otherwise we wouldn't have been able to go. But the reason I mention this is because right next to this retreat in the middle of Bahamas, there's this huge development called Atlantis. And it's such a huge development that I've seen in my travels, sometimes I go, like in Europe, you come out of an airport sometime and there's a video advertising Atlantis, go to Atlantis, enjoy. They have like the world's biggest underground aquarium. It's like underground, it goes for like hundreds and hundreds of meters. They have fish in there. They've got something that's got to be almost as wide as this room. So you can imagine how big the tank is and, people in a big casino and some world famous artist that did these beautiful, like, you know, $500,000 lamps, chandeliers in the ceiling, and all of this. And they have one room, the devotees were pointing out to me, they said, you see that bridge between the two buildings? I said, yeah. They said, that's a room. It's about the size of the castle. I said, that's a room? You mean they rent that? They said, yeah, it's $28,000 a night. Okay, so that's Atlantis. So, you know, and it looks, you know, there's a beach and there's a pool and, you know, everything you might want to enjoy. But before we left, I was asking some people, I said, you know, who owns this place? They said, well, actually right now, there's not an owner, there's a group of owners. And I said, really, is there some story behind that? They said, yeah. They said, this so-and-so man, I can't remember his name, they said, very, very wealthy businessman, real estate developer, and he built this huge place, huge success, you know, famous all around North America, people coming from South America, North America, Europe, so many places to this Atlantis, right? The famed city, right, that disappeared. So he's playing on people's desire, Atlantis. So fabulously wealthy, so fabulously wealthy that he decided he needs to build one more place, just like it, somewhere in the Middle East. And while he was doing that, his son, who was kind of the heir apparent to take over the business, because this man's about 70, his son was in a helicopter flying around, various looking for new places. Something went wrong, the helicopter crashed, his son's dead. So now he's got his big, huge place, he's so wealthy, you know, rich and famous people are coming to his place, but his son's dead, so who's going to get his property? And then he invests his big, big, big development in the Middle East, and unfortunately, that one loses money. So he takes all the profits in the first one to keep the second one going. That's not enough. So now he has to sell his property, Atlantis. So he loses his son. He loses his wealth. Soon he'll lose his life. So, you know, people go there and think, boy, the guy that owns this, what more could you possibly want? You know, there's Hollywood and Bollywood stars are coming to this place and he's the proprietor of the whole thing. But short-lived, right? Men in this age are but short-lived. They're unlucky. The helicopter crashes, that's definitely unlucky, isn't it? And always disturbed. So just imagine how disturbed this man must be, thinking, if I hadn't tried to expand, maybe my son wouldn't have gone in that helicopter. If I hadn't gone to the Middle East, I'd still have my billions of dollars. I'd still be peaceful. I'd still be enjoying. I mean, I can't say what he's thinking, but if he's not thinking some of those things, he's more stupid than we think he probably, you know, that's really stupid if he's not thinking that by now. So these are some of the difficulties that people experience. Just and we know, it's true, even people very, very successful probably gives the example of the medical patient who's saying to the doctor, at the end of his life, doctor, please, I'll pay you anything. Just give me a few more years. I just need a little more time. Just a couple more years. And of course, a couple more years, then you'd want a couple more years and a couple more years. I was talking with a man in Hungary a couple days ago who's a public health a student professional, and he's working on a master's degree. And he told me something, I'd read it before, and he said it too, so it's confirmed. He said, in modern medicine, 90% of the expense of medical care for people is spent during the last 3 months of their life. Now, in one sense, that's really a waste of money, but putting that aside, what does that mean? What's the consciousness behind that? Anybody say? What does that mean? They're spending 90% of their money.
They don't want to die.
They don't want to die. Anything. Operate, do this, you know. Heart operation, stomach operation, liver operation, this transplant, that. So many, just give me a few more days. And the whole culture's like that. And therefore, it's interesting, because just to try to expand what, according to Bhagavatam, is an unfulfilled life, with a few more unfulfilled days, practically they're ruining the economy of many of the world's nations. America, the economy is a mess. It was partly because of the war, but a big part of it now is because they can't afford the health care. Why can't they afford health care? Because 90% of the money is being spent to try to keep people that are about to die a few more days. And are they spent a few more days enjoying their senses? No, they're in a hospital bed someplace. Now, these are like, they got tubes in them, and they're like, so isn't it, to try to stretch that out. And of course we know the soul wants to live and that's there. But such unnecessary, such, anyway, whatever it is, whatever the value of it is, just the fact is so much money is spent, so symptomatic of how people want to live for a long time. So in the next verse, Prabhupada talks about, I'll just read the quick purport, it's a couple lines. Those who are not devotees of the Lord are careless and unintelligent. Unless one is thoroughly intelligent, one cannot be a devotee of the Lord. Those who are not devotees of the Lord fall prey to the actions of Kali. It will not be possible to bring about a saner condition in society unless we are prepared to accept the modes of action adopted by Pariksit Maharaj, that is, propagation of the devotional service of the Lord to the common man. Tenrasi says, to the common man. We have to get it out to the people in the streets. So Prabhupada uses these words, careless. Somebody who's careless means, you know, you say, be careful with that vase, be careful with the car, be careful with the baby. Something that has value, you misuse the value, you don't understand it, that's careless. And intelligent, you can't see things as they are. So people, they can't see things as they are, and they're not taking proper use of their human life. And therefore we know that in Western civilization, the Greek philosophers, they had the expression that an unexamined life is not worth living. I was noticing when I come here, because in America, practically everything's new. They build it, they tear it down, they build it, they tear it down. But here, when you drive to the villages or walk around, I was in Hungary, and just down the street from where I was staying was a Roman amphitheater. And, you know, you walk around those places, and you can't help but thinking, okay, the Romans were here, hooray, 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 kill them, shut them up, cut them up, chop them, like those assistants that tried to kill Prahlad Maharaj, right? Chop him, chop him. That was kind of the Roman culture. And then, you know, so you stand in one place and think, look, the Romans were here coming in and out with all of their very bizarre culture. And then whatever happened, they were overrun by different migrant tribes. So those people came in. Yes, we conquered this place. We've driven out the heathens or whatever. And then they partied or did whatever they did in that space. And then over time, so many kings came and went, and so many people lived nearby, little boys running and playing and throwing ball and stones and this and that underneath the tunnels. And then over time, it's wearing out more and more. And then, you know, modern civilization, and this battle, that battle, the Nazis came, the Russians came, these cat communists, blah, blah, blah. And there it sits rotting today. Where's all those people that were in that space? You know, the building's there. You drive just down the village, the streets in Belgium, like, you know, somebody buys a house. They're like the 37th person to own that house, you know, to open that door and think this is mine. So where's the other 36? You know, it's strange, material energy. Where are they all? They fall in prey, Prabhupada says, to the Kali Yuga, and they're suffering, and therefore Prabhupada is requesting we should try to help them. I was at a program in Washington, D.C. A couple months ago at the Vice the vice ambassador of the British, so it was like the second house of the British embassy, not the ambassador, the next guy down. It was a Diwali event. And I was there, I always do those things, Dodi and all that. And there was a group of young people, young Indians, a lot of very up-and-coming second-generation Indian Americans, generally very smart, very, you know, moving up the social and economic and political ladder very quickly. And so they were like, you know, a group of young, very sharp young men and young women standing there kind of talking. And as often is the case with those groups these days, they were quite drunk. At least this one young man was quite drunk. So he kind of saw me, you know, as we would say, a blast from the past. And he kind of came up and said, you know, so what are you all about? A little cynical, kind of like that. And I was put back a little bit, right? I thought, okay, Krishna, you know, let's don't be unnerved by this guy. He's just, you know what he is? He's just a drunk kid is what he is. So I said, you know, I'm a Hare Krishna priest. And he was, you know, kind of asking me some questions. He was challenging. He was arguing. You know, what are you doing? You're just praying all day long and you're not doing this, you're not doing that. And, you know, I said, what are you doing? You know, you have some kind of job. And he was just, you know, there was a couple young women there, so he's kind of showing off in front of the women, you know, strutting his stuff with his talk. But then we got into a little while, and I was kind of saying, yeah, but, you know, without attacking him, just saying, well, you know, some people say that there's other options in life that maybe we should consider, and that maybe just, you know, achieving a house like this and becoming rich and famous, maybe it's not enough. And as I started talking, at one point, a couple people walked away. And I can't remember what exactly stimulated this, but he said to me, he said, I am suffering and miserable like anything. You know, at first he's like, what are you doing? You know, why aren't you living like me, you fool? Look at me, I'm young, I'm strong, I'm handsome, I'm working my way up the ladder, I got pretty girls standing around me, I'm drunk, I'm having a good time. But you scratch the surface just a little bit, and he said, I'm so unhappy. I'm so unhappy. It was all a facade. Like the emperor's new clothes, right? It's just all the emperor's new clothes. There's no... So it's explained in these verses that people in this age, they can be helped by this simple process of hearing and chanting. It's a very difficult age, but Krishna makes it very, very easy for people to simply hear and chant. That's a great benefit of this age. And it doesn't mean that as devotees that we don't value other things. So it's like we read yesterday morning, those verses were saying, you know, if you do it was phenomenal, it's like a million ashramedha yajnas, or you give a mountain of gold to the brahmanas. And you know, other places, we are supposed to give charity to the brahmanas, right? You're supposed to do that. But it's just to make the emphasis, none of those are equal to the holy name, to chanting Krishna's names. It's so powerful, so beneficial. So just as a final comment, we have to take those kind of remarks in context and here too. It's not that we don't value or appreciate or encourage when appropriately medical science. You know, it's great that there's medical doctors. We want there to be doctors, especially when we hurt or when we fall out of a tree or when, you know, you get a little bump on your skin and if you don't take it off, your whole body's going to rot before your eyes. And, you know, there are those things out there. It's good that people are becoming scientists and trying to help combat environmental pollution and degradation, and it's good that there's people that want to become government servants and try to and be policemen and control criminals and you know figure out how to you know get power from solar panels and you know all those different kind of things, be businessmen, be successful, provide. We those things are great, but at the end of the day, the point that's being made here. None of those activities in and of themselves is capable of satisfying people. They don't satisfy the heart. It's probably described elsewhere in the purport in the first canto. There's a pinprick. So this guy in Atlantis, he's got this huge place, but there's a pinprick. I need just one more. And then when he tries to do that, there's a big pinprick. My son died. He crashed in a plane because I wanted more. I wasn't happy. So I pushed him, I forced him. I should have just said, take this one place and be happy. Live on the beach for the rest of your life. But no, I needed more. So this pinprick in his heart. And this man at the college, where I was at the college, you know, he's thinking, yeah, it was great back then. It's not very good now, but it was great back then. Pinprick in his heart. So at the end of the day, these material pursuits can't satisfy us, nor can they cleanse people's hearts. Because that's the other thing that's constantly nagging at people in this age. Hankering and lamentation. This is these two people. Hankering for another hotel, lamenting for the time past, always being pushed, always looking over their shoulder. Always looking somewhere else. Maybe I should leave this job and get another job. You know, the bosses are always worried, the employers are taking advantage, employees are worried, how can I take advantage? And therefore, Prabhupada says, you know, whatever people want in this age, if you want a family, wonderful. Have a great family, put Krishna in the center, you'll have a nice family. You want to be rich, great. Make a lot of money, but keep Krishna in the middle. Do it for Krishna. Use some of it for Krishna, for spiritual pursuit, and then it'll actually make people happy. People want to be powerful, famous, influence things in the world, great, but make it Krishna-ized, make it Krishna-centered. And then it can actually satisfy. So the same way, it's interesting, the parallel here, to end with this, the sages are trying to perform a sacrifice. They know their duty, they're Brahmins. They're supposed to do something to uplift the world. They know the place is a mess. They know it's Kali Yuga. They've heard they're supposed to do yajna. They all came together. They're trying to do yajna, and all they're getting is smoke. It's like, you know. And then Sunda Goswami comes, he starts speaking, and they realize, whoa, this sounds pretty interesting. Actually, we've heard some things about chanting is a good thing, and we know a little bit about Krishna. We've heard he's the Supreme Personality, but we don't quite get it. Like a lot of people, they say, yeah, they've heard there's God, And so, you know, he's up there. He started things in motion, and I should enjoy the world, right? That's what God means. Or they believe there's a God. He created everything. He got it running, and then he's gone away. Or maybe there's a God, maybe there's not. And who cares? Etc. All these different ideas, even among people that believe, they don't really know what does it mean that there's a God, that there's a supreme friend, a supreme controller, a supreme enjoyer, who you have the opportunity to connect to. They don't get that part of it. So the sages, they didn't quite get it. So Suta Goswami's coming saying, no, you got to add Krishna. You want to do yajna, add Krishna. So that's the message for us. That, you know, whatever it is, probably, you know, whoever you are, wherever you are, add Krishna. Add Krishna's name. And if we do so, despite the difficulties of this age of Kali, and they're long and they're vast, and each of us could write a whole book about the difficulties we have, we'd fill a library, we could call it the library of hellish experiences. We could each write a book about it, but you know, it's always mixed. There's some happiness, there's some distress. But if we add Krishna, then that's the perfection. This is the purport of these series of verses. So I'll stop there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Yes, Mataji. I didn't quite understand.
The Indian boy that you were talking to, was
yeah, yeah. Was he open to it?
When you said that,
not really. Drunk people generally can't think too clearly. I think I learned more from our exchange than he did. You know. Hopefully, you know, the next day when he woke up, in his headache, he remembered one or two things that I told him, but I don't know for sure. I haven't seen him since. I think I gave him a card and invited him to the temple. It stopped him in his tracks for a minute or two, but he definitely was a person that needed to learn a few more things. Yeah, yeah. I had experiences like that before I was a devotee. You know, you meet a spiritual person, it's like, wow, a moment of enlightenment, and then poof, you get pulled right back to your nonsense. So he was still in the, very much in the back and forth stage. Vishakha? Yes. Can you explain that to us? Yeah, you know, as I paused, I read it twice, at least did so in my mind. It's interesting. Prabhupada uses, it's an interesting use of the word envious, that Parikshit was not envious of the age of Kali. Generally, envy is, and we should have a dictionary to look it up, but generally, envy is when you have some ill feelings towards someone because you want something they have, isn't it? So maybe if we just build on that, Parikshit was not envious. He was not upset with Kali because of the influence that Kali had in this age. Because Kali's there, it's powerful. So Parikshit, I'm the king, but you're like the dark lord of the age. You know, you're like the evil side of kings in this age. Because I'm supposed to be the king, but you're here too, somehow behind the scenes, working through subtle means. But I'm not envious that you have that power. I'm not feeling ill against you because you have that power, because I know how to contain it. Prabhupada definitely says that. He knew how to contain it. That's why he didn't feel envious. So that's how I would kind of understand it.
You're interested in definition?
Yeah, the envy? Okay.
It says a feeling of discontented or resentful longing aroused by someone else's possessions, qualities, or luck.
Okay, great. So, resentment or ill feeling towards another aroused by their luck or their position. So, okay, you're the king, you've got so much power, but I'm not envious of you as a rival because I know how to contain you. And, of course, didn't seek particular value. Yes, bro.
It's quite inconceivable how a saintly person in this case, and also like Nityananda towards Jagannath Mata, was so forgiving, although they really, these persons, Kali and Jagannath Mata, had really hurt others, and they are like responsible for their protection, okay, and also Lord Nityananda.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, it's also, because hearing you talk about that, it's also interesting, we read in the Bhagavatam about so many saintly persons that really struggled to continue to act like that. You know, the classic case is Dhruva Maharaj, who went out to punish the murderers of his brother, and practically the whole, you know, the whole entourage of rulers of the universe had to come and tell him, hey, cool it, you've gone too far. And he's a great, great, great personality. And there's other examples. I mean, you read the Mahabharata, from time to time, you know, the Pandavas get a little overwhelmed by the battle. They started, you know, even though they never did, they got real close to quarreling between each other. And so you know, sometimes we think that being a devotee means you're not supposed to struggle, but we have, the Bhagavatam is full of great souls who struggle, and I think the real purport is they struggled, but they persevered, they continued to depend upon Krishna, therefore they were successful. Not that they were great souls and it was easy for them, and I'm lost because, you know, I'm dealing with lust, envy, anger, greed, and all of those things, but, you know, they're the examples for us. I mean, otherwise, why would Prabhupada even mention he wasn't envious? It's like, well, of course not. Why mention it? Why even mention it? Because it's a natural thing to be. He's the king, and there's this other alternative king who's, you know, infiltrating his kingdom. You know, and he's the son of Abhimanyu. He's the grandson of the Pandavas. You know, what is it? I mean, his father and his grandfather, they would never let those things happen. But it's happening on his watch, quote unquote. You know, it's my time. I'm the one who's supposed to be. And now you're here now when I'm here. So you could see he could easily. But he didn't. He didn't get envious. Why? Because he knew, okay, you're here. It's under Krishna's control. That's okay because I know how to counter it. So then Prabhupada goes into this wonderful purport connected to us. Prakshit wasn't disturbed because he knew how to counter it. So we're different than Prakshit, but we have our means of correcting it or dealing with it. By Krishna's grace, and then it goes on, we're not held responsible for the thoughts of the age, and we can take shelter of Krishna's name and counteract the whole age. It's a wonderful problem discussion. Yes? Last comment or question? Right, because we should quit soon.
You were just mentioning we're not responsible for our thoughts, and I feel sometimes like a trap because, you know, what you think or you do, it's kind of a gradual process. And, specifically constrained in this movement with the rules, etc. So then we let our thoughts go, but it's really a trap for actually doing these things as the Gita has mentioned, what you meditate upon itself.
Right.
So I feel, I don't know why it's mentioned so often, I'm hard time understanding why it's repeated so often. I feel it's a bit of a trap.
Why it's repeated so often that you're not held responsible for your thoughts?
Yeah. Well,
I don't think it is. Maybe in our classes it is. But, yeah. Because the other side is there, and thanks for pointing that out. It's like I'm not held responsible for my thoughts. It means there's no immediate karmic reaction for those thoughts. However, as you're pointing out, if I don't if I don't at least tolerate those thoughts and just let them go, if I don't practice some process of purifying my mind and my heart so those thoughts become quieted, then I may end up being forced to act upon them. It's kind of like the government. It's like, okay, you get a 30-day grace period, you know, like you have to pay your taxes by May 1st, but they give you an extra 30 days. Okay, if it's in by, you know, by June 1st, you're okay. But that doesn't mean, so now don't pay them. Because then you're getting in big trouble. So, okay, we're not held responsible for the thoughts, but we can't meditate on those thoughts. And that takes a lot of effort. No, it takes a lot of effort. We have to tell our mind, no, thank you. You know, mind says, I'll do this. Somebody, you know, we have to go, hold on here. Just wait a minute. I don't want that, okay? I don't want that. I'm not going to think about it, and I don't want that. Thank you very much. I'm going to go do this. And then brings it up again. Hello, I just told you, I don't want that. You know, you have to sometimes stop like that.
It's a little bit, you know, you don't have to be responsible for your thoughts, but at the same time, you have uncontrolled mind. So it's like, actually, you can do nothing with it, because if the mind is not controlled, any bad thought, they want to practice. So it's not much that you can do with this. Yes.
Well, it says particularly if we meditate, right, while contemplating the objects of the senses, so allowing the mind to focus and not trying to bring it back. And as long as we bring it back, you know, Krishna's there, he'll help us. So that's why we have to continue to bring it back. And that's a big reason why Prabhupada gave us so many different activities in Krishna consciousness. He didn't tell us to chant, you know, 64 rounds a day, because he said for Westerners, they can't do it. Their minds will never, you know, won't be possible. So he gave us very, very, you know, busy. I remember hearing from one senior devotee that Prabhupada one time, I can't remember how it led up to it, but somebody was late or something like that for a little darshan. And they said, you know, where's this person? They said, well, you know, she or he, they're busy doing service. And Prabhupada said, yes, we should always be busy in Krishna's service. Otherwise, it went like this. Otherwise, Maya will say, come and join with me. Pull us in. So that's one reason we always want to be busy. Not frantic busy, but busy, occupied. Okay. Is it okay to go till 9? I don't know. I don't want to break the etiquette. Hands keep going up. What's it's all right? Okay. So here and then back.
Yeah, we always talk about this, but it says in the verse that if you think auspicious things, then immediately the results will be there. Mm. So that's the solution. So just think.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Thank you. That's the point. We should think auspicious things, and you never read that before?
No.
So from day forward, your life is going to be much more auspicious.
Yeah. Right.
Very good.
And it's even in the Sanskrit.
Very good.
I didn't know that either. I thought it was just something that...
Yeah. Aren't you glad you came to class today?
Yeah.
And just think what secrets you'll find tomorrow. And the next day. Yes. Oh, you had your hand? Yeah. Yeah, we can't play with that, definitely. It's like you're speeding on the highway and the policeman pulls you over and says, you know, you were going 20 kilometers over the speed limit. And you say, I'm really, really sorry. And he says, okay, I'll let you off this one time. And then you turn the corner and you go 20 miles over and he stops you again. He says, I just told you. So, okay, now you're in big trouble. He gave you a little space, but then we didn't take it, you know. That's why Prabhupada says, they're careless. People are careless and unintelligent. They have a human form of life. It's really, really valuable, but they're careless. And they're unintelligent because, you know, they're not stopping and thinking, okay, the guy that owned Atlantis is suffering like anything. So why should I try to, you know, get my little house and think that in and of itself is going to make me happy? The guy with this huge, huge, huge place is not happy. So how's it going to make, you know, how's it going to make me happy? So, you know, so they're not analytical, and they don't use the discrimination. So the two things, they don't discriminate to understand the valuable thing they have, and then having that valuable thing, they're not using it right. So then we have to make sure we use it right. And it's hard because our senses and our mind are pulling us at every second. You don't want to do that. You don't want to come to Bible time class tomorrow. Yeah, okay, you got one nice thought, but it's so much better to sleep in. Right? Immediately the mind goes back to that. But Prabhupada says we keep pulling it, and gradually it comes to Krishna's lotus feet. Yes.
Actually, there are people who have everything in life. Unlike the example with the owner of Atlantis you gave, there are people who own everything, who have everything in life, but still they're not happy.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened in the 50s, and the psychologists coined the term successful malcontents.
Successful malcontents.
Yes. They noticed the increased number of people who apparently have everything, like settled family life, friends, hobbies, lots of money, they can afford anything they want, but still they come to psychologists saying, is that it? Please help me, I'm not happy.
Yeah. Yeah, in many Western countries, I know in the United States, like, you know, therapy is a growth industry. It's getting bigger and bigger because people, right, that's the experience, you know, like you hear the doctor, I got everything, but I'm not happy. But yeah, because you're not that body. You're spirit soul. You have everything but spiritual. That you know, it's mentioned in one of these purports I didn't read. Prabhupada can give us an example of Vyasadeva was unhappy and he couldn't figure out why. he compiled all the Vedas, he, you know, glorified the demigods, he compiled so many histories, and like, something's missing. You know, Narada came and said, hello, you haven't glorified Krishna. Directly, you have to glorify Krishna. So people are like, geez, I'm healthy, but I'm not happy. Okay. I'm rich, but I'm not happy. Okay. I'm famous, but I'm not happy. I'm beautiful, but I'm not happy. I'm powerful, but I'm not happy. What's wrong? Same thing. You're not connected to Krishna. Because that's who we are. We're connected to Krishna. You know, Prabhupada said, you take the screw out of the machine, it's laying on the ground. You're a screw. You got to be connected to the machine. So we're devotees of Krishna. We're part of Krishna. Yes?
So you say, be satisfied with your misery and reduce, you know, give all to Krishna. Then you're happy.
Gradually. Because we're still affected by the material world and material consciousness, but as we become more and more aware of our relationship with Krishna, then we naturally become more happy. And the material things kind of go quiet.
Yes.
Yeah, gradually. And it's not necessarily like this or like that. Spiritual life's kind of like this. You know? It has its ups and downs. We experience it. Sometimes you come to the temple, you look at the deities, you associate the devotees, you feel such happiness. You think, boy, this is great. It's going to last forever. And then, you know, the next day you have a different experience. Maybe not so good. Because we're, you know, it's a gradual process of purification. Yeah, a little bit up and down. Okay? Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Gaur Premanandi.
Thank you. But it's true. I'm wondering when am I going to get the results. Thinking about it.